the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest is Senator Thurston Morton of Kentucky, chairman of the Republican National Committee. One of his responsibilities in this election year is to make the best case for the Republican Party and defend its record against opposition attack. Last Wednesday, the Republicans held fundraising dinners in 80 cities. Both in attendance and dollars, they broke all records. But even as President Eisenhower and other party leaders were praising the administration's accomplishments, the Democrats were rising to the attack with a strong criticism of the defense program. The state of our defenses is certain to be one of the chief campaign issues. Before his election to the Senate in 1956, Senator Morton served 6 years in the House of Representatives and 3 years as Assistant Secretary of State. Seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Morton, are William Lawrence of the New York Times, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, John Steele of Time and Life magazines, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Senator, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Senator Morton, according to a Gallup poll published today, Republican Party strength has hit a new low point. I believe it was 42% against 58% for the Democratic Party. Now, Vice President Nixon is too closely identified with the Republican Party in its present image. How can he win?
Well, in the first place, I think that by that same poll, we were down 8 months ago to 39%. And I might say that that poll is a reflection of the balance in the country today, as nearly as we can tell, of party strength. I think the question is generally, would you rather have a Republican or the Democrats run in the Congress? And I think the ratio of Republicans to Democrats is about 42 to 58, or 40 to 60, more accurately. So I think the poll reflects that rather than the personalities of the candidates who will be running. And I think that that same situation just prevailed in past years. We are, unfortunately, a minority party in this country, and yet we have won presidential elections, and I think will.
Well, isn't Vice President Nixon running ahead today in the polls because he is identifying himself with the Eisenhower image rather than the Republican Party image?
Well, I think he's running ahead for several reasons. One is that I think a majority of the people think that he's the best qualified man to succeed President Eisenhower as President of the United States. And I think that it's the Nixon image.
How do you explain the fact that President Eisenhower, in power almost 8 years, has been unable to change the image of the Republican Party in the minds of so many people?
Well, I think it has been changed to some extent. I think that President Eisenhower has concentrated on running the country more than on building the party, perhaps. And however, that was what he's in there for. That was what he was elected to do, was to run the country. And I think that there is some change in party image, however. I think we're going to get more, we have gotten and will get younger, more aggressive, articulate candidates to run. I think that's necessary. That's a part of the party image, as a composite photograph of those who hold or seek office.
Senator Morton, as chairman of the Republican Party and as a longtime Republican, you must have your own image of the Republican Party, which you would like the American people to accept. Can you tell us what you would like that image to be, what you believe that image is now, and what you would like the American people to accept?
Well, I think that the Republican Party is a party that's dedicated to all of the people, not to any one group. I think it is a party that fights federal control or the concentration of power in the federal government. I think the Republican Party today is more of a states' rights party than the Democratic Party. I think that we try to find ways of solving problems without bringing them to the federal level. I think the Democratic Party today is a party that seeks to solve all problems, or many of them in the Democratic Party, seek to solve all problems first at the federal level.
Mr. Steele.
Senator Morton, I want to go back to that poll business for a minute. Men and women aren't born as Republicans or Democrats. What makes you run so poorly in the poll? Why aren't there more people favoring you? Is it the party record in Congress, or is it your candidates, or what's the reason, do you
think? Well, I think there is a certain tradition in politics. I think we are. We change and we have freedom of choice, but I think to a degree we are born members of one party or the other if our parents have been active in one party or the other, just as we are members of one denomination, one church or another. We, of course, many times change, and we certainly change in elections. I mean, we've seen that illustrated time and time again. You take the South, for instance, where I suppose 90-95% of the people are in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, but in this strange era, you have the president be winning twice by these tremendous margins and yet only carrying a Republican Congress once, the first time. Now, what happens? Where do the Republican voters who vote for Eisenhower as president go when it comes time to vote for Congress? Why don't they go along with you?
Well, obviously, many of them voted for the Democrat who was running for Congress and voted for Mr. Eisenhower and the vice president.
Why is this?
Well, I suppose they thought they were better qualified in their minds, or they had an affinity with that party, and they thought the president transcended that party affinity or that party loyalty sufficiently so they'd scratch for him but didn't scratch all the way down the ticket.
What are you trying to do to correct this? Are you trying to get better candidates?
Better candidates? More activity, better organization. I think the American people are tremendously responsive to organization efforts. And I think in 58 the facts absolutely prove that our party did not do an organization job, and we're trying to build so that we will in 1960.
Do you think that maybe this comes about because the Republican Party has put too much strength, too much stress on the immense personal popularity of President Eisenhower? They've run on his coattails too much?
Oh, no, because I think this goes back before President Eisenhower ran. I think you can find
evidence. You didn't even elect a president then for 25 years.
No, I think complacency, lack of doing the organization job in our party has been a serious weakness of our party, and that we're trying to correct. And I think we have corrected it recently.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator, don't you think it's kind of un-American that Republicans at the convention are not going to have any choice as to who's going to be their nominee?
Oh, they can have a choice if anybody wants to get in the race.
Well, you don't deny you cold-shouldered out the only other leading candidate.
I don't agree that he was cold-shouldered. I don't agree, Miss Craig, that he was cold-shouldered out at all. Mr. Rockefeller took a very realistic appraisal of the situation, and I think saw that most Republicans favored the vice president.
Yes.
And got himself out of the race.
He said in his withdrawal statement that those who will control a Republican convention do not want a contest. Were you one of those?
No, I was disappointed. I had no fear of a contest. I think it would have been a good thing in some states. Now, undoubtedly, certain states, state leaders did not want a contest in their particular states, and I can understand their reasoning. People in politics just don't like contests at times. In other states, I think they would have welcomed a contest, or certainly wouldn't have been opposed to a contest. But I think he found that 67% of the Republicans, approximately, were for Vice President Nixon, and they were the ones that were going to select the delegates. And I think he found that over 70% of the Republicans between 21 and 30 were for Mr. Nixon, and I think that those were factors that led him to make up his mind.
Well, Mr. Nixon has since said that a vice president, for instance, should not be chosen geographically, and he should have all the qualifications for a president in case he should succeed, and that his views should coincide with the views of the nominee that's the top of the ticket. Well, would that not have left Mr. Rockefeller out anyhow?
As vice president?
Yes. I mean, he was talking about Rockefeller for vice president, even if he would.
Well, I read very carefully Mr. Rockefeller's speech of last Wednesday night, Mr. Nixon's speech. I thought ideologically they were very close together. The fact that geography's ruled out doesn't mean that New York would be ruled out.
Well, I didn't quite agree with you that there was no differences. Let me ask you this. Who's your favorite for the keynote at your convention? Would you like Rockefeller to do that?
Well, I certainly think he ought to take a part in our convention. Now, who will be the keynoter? I don't know. It'll be decided by the National Committee in May. I think it's too early to make the decision now.
Are you in favor of Joe Martin, perhaps as the chairman again, or not?
I think that Representative Martin, that my good friend Joe Martin, should certainly, and I know that he will, have a position of prominence and honor in the convention.
But not the chairman.
I don't know. That's up to the committee to decide.
Mr. Lawrence.
Senator, to be politically realistic about this, looking back at that poll that was mentioned at the outset, you have no chance at all to capture the Senate this year.
I'm afraid you're right, Mr. Lawrence. We're going to make some gains, I hope, but mathematically we cannot capture control of the Senate.
And based on this poll, you certainly get very little encouragement on the fact that you might capture the House either, do you?
Well, poll or no poll, I still feel that we've got a good chance of capturing the House, and we're going after it.
But it's a hard uphill
fight. It's a hard uphill fight. Any Republican victory, especially in my state, I'll tell you, is a hard uphill fight.
Well, now, let's talk about your state for a moment. Last time you were elected, you had a Democratic governor in office who was helping you. That Governor Chandler is now out of office. How do you realistically assess your own chances of re-election to the Senate?
Well, I'm not up this year.
Oh, you're not up?
No, Senator Cooper's up this year, and I think he's going to be reelected. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
You think Kentucky will go
Republican? He's tremendously popular down there. I think that in this century, the two most popular political figures that have crossed the horizon in Kentucky are the late Senator Barkley and Senator Cooper.
Well, Senator, there's been a lot of talk of you for vice president.
That's talk.
That's only talk?
Let's face it, Mr. Lawrence, I've got a Democratic governor, and we don't give up Senate seats. As I've already told you, it's too hard to get them. We're not going to be able to get control of the Senate, and we're certainly not going to give up a Senate seat in our nomination of a vice presidential candidate.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, the other day, President Eisenhower said that if you give the people the facts, they will come to the right conclusion. And you'll then have the mightiest force there is in the United States, an informed public opinion. I'm sure you agree with that. Can you tell us what you consider to be the facts in this space race, since this is bound to be a very important issue in the coming campaign?
Yes. Well, as a citizen and as a member of the United States Senate, I have the highest confidence in those who are making the tough decisions that have to be made as to the format of our defense posture. I think that they're developing on balance, a deterrent force, and have in being a deterrent force, which I think is the greatest force for peace in the world. And whereas, of course, I am, as all Americans, unhappy that we have not, in some of the more spectacular phases with the big boost weapons, been able to develop moonshots, or things of that kind, and I realize the psychological impact on the world. Nevertheless, so far as our defense is concerned, I have confidence in those who are responsible.
Well, do you think that we have lost international prestige as a result of Soviet superiority in space? There seems to be some question about that, difference of opinion between the president and Mr. York and George Allen, director of USIA.
Well, there's no question about it that the first Sputnik was a terrific... had a terrific psychological impact. I happened to have been in Southern Asia at the time that achievement went off. And I suppose the Luna shot had a certain impact. On the other hand, I read this morning by the man who's coming back from the Washington Post, I think, who's been their European correspondent, who's coming back to this country, indicating that the fact that Russians have made this advance and that there are two powers in the world today with deterrent strength has probably contributed to the easing of tensions in the minds and hearts of those people.
Will you tell us what you think to be the facts on the ICBM? Do you think the Soviet Union has more intercontinental ballistic missiles and is producing faster than we are today?
They probably have more right now and maybe producing them faster. I think that, however, in other areas of defense, that we are ahead of the Russians. And remember that today, the deterrent force is not the intercontinental ballistic missile, but the strategic bomber.
Well, you think, for example, that the fact that someone can press a button and in 15 minutes rain ICBMs on this country is not of great, grave and great importance?
I think
you
it
may
is.
Never have a chance to retaliate.
I think it is of grave importance, but I think that's a mistake to assume that today, as of today, people can press buttons and in 15 minutes or whatever it is, this country will be destroyed. I don't think that's true. I think the big deterrent force today is the strategic bomber. We're way ahead of Russia in not only number of bombers, but in numbers of trained crews. And remember, the bomber can carry a much heavier load of destruction than can the intercontinental ballistic missile.
We're guessing on what ICBMs the Soviet Union has. I think Mr. Khrushchev said they were building in one factory something like 250 a month. And we're only guessing that they aren't building as many as they can.
I think you're speaking of the
missiles.
Middle-range missile.
All missiles.
All missiles, yes. That includes but he didn't imply, Mr. Khrushchev didn't, that they're building 250 ICBMs per month.
No, but he said one factory alone was building 250 missiles a month.
Yes, well, missiles cover a pretty broad category, and of course we're building any number of missiles per month, too, when you get into the shorter range missiles.
And
the air-to-ground missiles that we're building.
And General Power said that some 300 ballistic missiles could virtually wipe out a whole nuclear strike.
Yes.
And don't you think, then, that it is a matter of grave importance that they are producing this in ICBMs today, as everyone admits they are?
I think that this whole thing is a matter of grave importance. But what I'm trying to point out is that in the development of submarines with the Polaris, of your carrier-based bomber, of your SAC-based bomber, we have a deterrent force today. We have the power to knock them out. Let's assume that they have the power to knock us out and we have the power to knock them out. Then you get to, there is no rationale. You avoid miscalculation if you keep them convinced that you have the power to knock them out.
You believe that
is the force for peace.
You believe at the present time that they haven't got the power with the ICBM, that they cannot press a button and in 15 minutes knock out our retaliatory power.
No, I don't believe that they can knock us out without our inflicting damage on them so great that they will not choose to try to knock us out.
Mr. Steele.
Senator Morton, over and over again, you've talked about today. Today, isn't it a fact that our military leaders aren't a bit worried about today? It's the period from mid-1962 through 1963 that is the period of great peril when the missile gap does open up. Are you not concerned about what happens then?
Well, certainly I'm concerned. That's why I'm glad to see us going ahead so rapidly with the submarine and Polaris combination, which I personally think, maybe I'm prejudiced having been in the Navy, which I personally think is a very effective weapon. And I think we too are going ahead. We've already stepped up our Atlas bases in the plan for this year from 20 to 27 squadrons, as I recall, of Atlas and Titans. So we are going ahead and stepping this up. As intelligence information comes in and causes you to change your estimates, you have to change.
Well, Senator, is it not true that nobody has contradicted what a Republican defense secretary said a year ago, that we had a 3-to-1, we had the possibility of trailing 3-to-1? Our leaders have said that it may not be that big, but nobody has said we're going to have more of the number one weapon, the ICBM. Wouldn't you build some more?
More of that particular weapon.
ICBMs.
But we may be way ahead in other weapons that can equally effectively do the job.
But isn't that the prime weapon of the future?
And remember this, that if you get enough to completely destroy them, what are you building the rest for? Sport and exercise?
Indeed not, but how do we know that they won't destroy us first?
Well, I mean, that's a question of having your retaliatory bases, underground, hard bases, mobile bases, which we are developing, the mobile bases,
Senator,
so that they always take that chance on being knocked out themselves.
If the authority was yours, would you try to close this missile gap and reverse it?
Well, we're trying to close the missile gap.
Well, we could
the missile
a great
gap
deal
is a result of a lack of research. It was done in the 6 years following World War II. And we're trying to. Now, the money isn't everything in reversing this thing. You can say, all right, give them $10 billion more. You got to have the brains, the ability, the talent to do it.
But you're not suggesting we lack those things or that we could step up our production today from a very minimal per month production, are you?
We can probably step our production up just as we stepped our production up from B-52s and B-36s and found the B-36s obsolescent when they came off the line. We started selling them for scrap.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator Morton, there are more women voters than men, and I got the woman vote in 52 and 56. Do you think that Nixon can hold that woman vote?
Yes, I do.
Why do you think so?
Because I think the women are very, very intelligent, and I think that they realize that you have a man here who is trained for this job, who has the qualifications for the job, who would make the best president of the United States. I think the women are mighty smart people, and I think they're going to vote for him.
Have you read the Claire Booth Luce story in a current magazine that says that while women are basically and potentially equal with men, that they don't have the chance to get experience in those young years when they're staying home and having children and the men are building up to careers. Now, she says that women are not now qualified, not any, to be either president or vice president. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think in the political realities that there'll be some time in this country before you elect a woman, either president or vice president, but I don't agree that there aren't women who potentially are qualified for these positions.
Well, she gives the reasons why they're not qualified, that they don't have military experience or the knowledge of, very wide knowledge of international affairs, which she says a president and a vice president who must succeed should have. And she herself has been mentioned, so she's put herself out. Now, let me ask you this. She suggests that there ought to be a constitutional amendment so we'd have a second vice president, and that it would be understood by everybody, the platforms and the candidates, that that would be a woman. What would you think of that suggestion?
Well, I know there have been suggestions that there be a second vice president to sort of be vice president in charge of administrative, the executive, and another one to handle the legislative, presiding over the Senate. I can conceive a woman very easily being in a position of, if it were worked out so that one vice president, let's say, presided over
the
Senate.
She suggests that that be a constitutional amendment be proposed and that then it be understood informally that that would be a woman.
Well, we've got a constitutional amendment before the Senate right now, and by the time we get through debating it, we won't have time at this station, at this session, I don't think, to take up Ambassador Luce's...
Well, let me ask you one more question. Do you really think that women would vote for a woman president or vice president, or would they prefer a man?
Why do you ask me? You're a woman. You ought to know that.
Oh, you're the a politician.
Answer to that. So I'm not going to say anything to try to dissuade any of the women's vote from the Republican Party.
Senator, you were quoted about a month ago as saying that some members of your national committee felt that Secretary Benson would be doing the party a favor if he were to resign. Does that feeling still persist among these members of your committee?
There are a few, I think, that regard Mr. Benson as a political liability, yes.
There's only one man outside of Mr. Benson himself who can take Mr. Benson out of office, and that's the president. What do you think that he has any intention of relieving Mr. Benson of his duties?
I do not, sir. I don't think he has any intention of relieving Mr. Benson, and I think that there are more members of our national committee who would be opposed to that action.
Mr. Lawrence.
Senator, has it ever occurred to you that despite his withdrawal announcement, Governor Rockefeller still might be a contender by the time of the Republican nomination?
Conceivably. I see no tangible evidence of it anywhere. I mean, it could happen, of course. The vice president could, well, stub his toe some way badly between now and July, which I certainly don't anticipate. Any number of things could happen that would get the governor back into the race, but I can't see them now.
Well, it is true, of course, that the vice president's popularity in these polls and his ability to run ahead of Democrats has gone up greatly just about since last July when he took off for the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And, of course, for the same reasons he went up, he could come down. Is that not right?
Well, yes, he could. I think there are more reasons for his going up than that particular trip. But there are reasons that, of course, he could come down. I don't anticipate them.
Did you get a report on Governor Rockefeller's conduct here last Wednesday night when he seemed very much like a candidate as he table hopped all over the place and shook hands and signed autographs. I've never seen anybody leave a head table at one of these formal $100 plate things.
Well, all of us who hold public office like a crowd, and we like to get around and shake hands with the crowd. I don't overlook many opportunities to shake hands, especially when I'm in Kentucky. Of course, I don't know how many votes there are in the district, but I'm sure that the governor, in his enthusiasm of a great meeting, as any man who holds political office, was in a friendly mood, and he's a man of very friendly person, you know. He likes people, he has great magnetism and charm, and I think he did a very gracious thing. Well, he pleased the crowd.
He had quite specific criticisms of the way the Republican Party is run and its weaknesses. How did these charges and these assertions affect you personally?
I agree with some of his criticisms.
More crusaders?
I agree that we need, well, he can call them crusaders, I'll call them bell ringers. I'll call them workers at the precinct level. We need a lot more, and I'm determined that we're going to get more.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Morton, Governor Rockefeller seems to have gone out of his way to avoid endorsing Vice President Nixon by name. How important is this going to be to you?
Oh, I feel sure that the Vice President is our nominee, that the whole organization from top to bottom in New York State will be absolutely in our camp, working hard to deliver New York to the Republican column, and I think they'll do it.
You say you feel sure. Have you talked to Governor Rockefeller about this? Have you any assurance that he will mention it?
I have had assurances, not from the governor personally, because I haven't talked to him, but I have had assurances from his national committeeman and other leaders of his party, of our party in New York. And they're a fine bunch, I might say.
Senator Morton, you're in fine shape to give us a brief footnote on history. You see a lot of the president these days about political matters. Tell us something about his interest in politics.
I don't think we're going to be able to get into that, gentlemen.
He's very much
Mrs.
interested,
Craig, gentlemen. I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Monitor's thanks to Senator Thurston B. Morton of Kentucky, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and to the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence C. Spivak. Now, a personal word, if I may. This month of January is very important to our non-citizen listeners. A message from the Immigration and Naturalization Service asks us to remind all non-citizens in the United States they must report their addresses to the government during this month. The government makes it as easy as possible for you to comply with this requirement of law. Just go to the nearest post office or immigration service office and ask for an alien address card. Then fill out that card and return it to the clerk. Do not mail the card. If you're ill or unable to obtain the card yourself, a friend or relative may obtain the card for you. Your friend would then return it to the post office or immigration office for you after you've filled out the card. Today is the last day of January. Be sure you comply with this law immediately if you are not a citizen. ¶¶